Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, welcoming you to Valley Writers Read, a program where only Valley writers get to read their literary prose. Tonight, I'm going to be reading a profile of a very fine lady named Catherine Haw Chin, who unfortunately passed away some years ago. Nevertheless, hers is an exciting and informative story, and it's entitled Catherine. I started teaching at Edison High School in Fresno in 1948. At that time, the first period of every day was what the school called a home room. It was a period shorter than all the other periods where we teachers took roll, read the bulletin, and where students could put the final touches on their homework assignments and get ready for the day. In my first year, I was assigned 32 ninth graders, and lo and behold, I was assigned those same students for the next 3 years until they graduated, so that for 4 years, just about the exact same young people and I met in the exact same room for at least a half an hour or so the first thing every school morning. In 1952, they graduated, and I was drafted into the Army. As the years went by, I often wondered about those home roomers. What do you suppose ever happened to them? Did they go right to work, to college, get married, move out of Fresno? So in about 1985, I contacted 20 of them, found out what they were up to, and wrote a book about them. The book is called Home Room, and the story I'm going to read to you tonight is about one of those students. Catherine has come to believe that Edison was an okay place where everybody was friendly, where she had her share of fun, and where she achieved pretty well according to the school's standards. But when you get out to Fresno State and got into biology and chemistry, she remembers, I felt so terribly helpless and so dumb, just like a hick. The only one that prepared you for Fresno State was Belle Hassler, who taught you how to write well enough to pass the English exam so you didn't have to take bonehead English. Catherine's real crisis hit when she just about flunked geology. It was so depressing. God, what am I doing here? She asked herself repeatedly and simply quit after her freshman year. Childhood games are over, she told herself. Time to get a job. Which brings us to June 1953. Instead of sitting in class at college, she was enrolled in a week's training program at the telephone company. With a rate sheet in one hand and a fictitious telephone log in the other, her assignment was to figure out the bill. A 5.5-minute call from Fresno to L.A. So if the rate per minute was so much, what is the charge? Another 3-minute call to Reno. On and on. 8 hours of no-brainer boredom. You can do better than this, she told herself. The man behind the counter at the California State Employment Office sent her to a corporate office to apply for a clerk typing position. Why, that job was filled weeks ago, said the department head with a shrug. I don't know why he sent you here. When she went back to complain at the employment office, the man looked at her somewhat annoyed. Look, just go back to your, restaurant or laundry, he said. We'll call you. But they never did. And it wasn't until a week later that she realized how that man had put her down. Even too dumb to know when somebody insults you, she grumbled to herself. A few weeks later, she learned that Fresno County was giving their annual typing exam. Figuring she had nothing to lose, she took it, and within a week a friendly elderly man called to ask if she would like to collect traffic fines for the county. Why not? She remembers her first day because it was Mexican Independence Day, September 16, 1953. Her workstation was on the ground floor of the old Fresno County Courthouse. The salary, $85 a month. It would be the first day of 42 years of service to the County of Fresno. There were three collection windows in her department, two of which were always open. They would open the third one if the lines were extraordinarily long. People who have traffic tickets to pay are hardly ever in a good mood. On the contrary, Catherine remembers them venting their anger at the clerks behind the counter, boiling over with rude remarks. Most of them had crazy excuses as to why they had been ticketed. "I was running out of gas," a woman might say defensively. "Had to speed to a service station to fill up. You understand, don't you?" Many told her the officers were picking on them. "He only stopped me because I was driving a Porsche, a Corvette, a Volkswagen, a Cadillac," or "he nailed me because I'm a hippie, a woman, Mexican, black. Can't you reduce the fine?" they would ask. "I mean, I won't do it again." When Catherine could get a word in edgewise, she would tell them, "Well, you do have the right to see the judge." "Don't forget, I'm a taxpayer," they would scowl in return, "and we taxpayers pay your salary," and then call her a bloodsucker as they handed over the money. But while it wasn't all that pleasant dealing with the public, Catherine found the people on her side of the counter friendly and supportive. In those days, if you had $1,000 in your drawer at the end of the day, it was considered a big day. Parking tickets were $1, running a stop sign, $5, reckless driving, $100, drunk driving, $125, just pocket money in comparison to what they get for the same offenses today. Around the mid-60s, Catherine was put in charge of automating the way people pay traffic fines and other money owed to the county. In 1963, 10 years after she had started with the county, two courtroom clerk jobs opened up. Although these positions were advertised all over, the county favored promoting from within. Catherine applied, was accepted, and soon found herself clerk of traffic court, which had just been moved from the old to the new courthouse. In those days, the judges traded off assignments. Each worked in criminal, civil, and traffic court in rotation. Her first boss was Judge Dan Iman, who later founded the San Joaquin School of Law. Every day, hordes of people traipsed into traffic court. They would wander around, talk to just about anyone, trying to figure out how to beat the system. Court would start at 10 in the morning, recess for lunch at 12, and start up again at 1:30. Sometimes people just didn't have the money to pay their fines, so they worked them off in jail time at $5 a day. For some minor offenses, traffic school might be an option. Good attendance and documented progress might even get your case dismissed. Each judge was a little different as to how much he fined for various violations. Some were noticeably hard on certain offenses, such as drunk or reckless driving. Some were lenient on hardship cases, especially if the individual was working. Some were practical and might ask the defendant, "If I reduce your fine from $60 to $20, can you pay it today?" Catherine marveled at the way defendants, who could be so rude to the clerks outside, transformed themselves into perfect little angels once they got inside the courtroom. Brash and aggressive out front, they magically became humble and respectful inside. At 3 o'clock every day, traffic trials would commence. Those hearings allowed people accused of traffic violations to confront the officers who had given them tickets. In the early days, when all traffic violations were misdemeanors, a DA would be present in the courtroom to act as the prosecutor. Later, when most traffic violations were reduced to infractions, the judge would hear the case himself. Most of these proceedings would last less than 15 minutes, after which the judge rendered his or her decision. Judge Ralph Moradian always assessed high fines. If a defendant failed to come in after signing a promise to appear, he issued a warrant for that person's arrest, and the bail on the original $10 fine was raised to $100. When the defendant was brought in, the judge would fine him the whole $100, but extended him more time to pay. And if he didn't or couldn't pay the $100, the bail might be raised even higher. In this way, Judge Moradian made a lot of money for the county during his tenure, and there were a lot of people who went to jail for non-payment of fines. As time went by, Catherine left traffic court and clerked for other judges in other departments. In total, she worked as a court clerk for over 30 years, so it's no wonder that she knew just about all of the judges. Her overall opinion of the court system in the county was favorable. "They're just all human beings," she'd tell you. "Judges, lawyers, some are nice, some are snotty. And jury members? Well, they're always grumbling, but you can't blame them. Jury duty means time away from jobs and home and a lot of waiting around." But at the end of the day, she gave the system good marks. "It's our way of preserving law and order, of putting undesirables behind bars where they belong, of giving those accused of wrongdoing a chance to defend themselves, and of giving people who have legitimate complaints a chance to get their grievances adjudicated. If you're an indigent, you're automatically assigned a public defender. And those guys are real lawyers," she pointed out with certainty. "Sometimes defendants balk at having public defenders appointed to represent them, but after they try to get their own lawyers, they usually are more than happy to accept the public defenders chosen for them by the judges." Court clerks have a lot to do. It was Catherine's job to help set up and post the court calendar, swear in witnesses, answer the phone in court, record the judge's verdicts and orders, make sure that all copies of official documents go to the proper places, be the custodian of trial exhibits, prepare commitment orders, figure out the days spent in jail and the release dates for committed persons, and get all the parties together so that court can be convened. "And even when everything else is done," she recalled, "there's always more paperwork to be done. Seems like you can never catch up on that." One time, during a crowded small claims court session, where it was the custom to swear in all the litigants and witnesses at the same time, Catherine asked them all to raise their right hands. All but one man sitting on the third row in the aisle did so. He raised his left hand. She paused, looked straight at him, and when she was satisfied that she had made eye contact, repeated herself, only louder this time. "Please raise your right hand," she insisted. But the man kept his left hand up, though he looked around, perplexed. "He ain't got no right hand," the bailiff whispered in her ear. "Can't you see his right sleeve flopping in the breeze?" Some of the most heart-wrenching cases were held in small claims court. "Familiarity breeds contempt" is the saying that applies. Attorneys are not allowed, and because often the cases involve people who, though they knew each other, were still suing each other, family members, ex-spouses, live-ins, tenants, landlords, there was a high level of anger, bitterness, and drama. In 1952, when small claims court was originated, the maximum a person could sue for was $100. Today, it's $7,500. For 8 years, Catherine was assigned as Judge George Hopper's clerk. If there was ever a perfect person, Catherine thought this judge was it. Although gruff on the outside, she found him to be a very fair and sweet person. For example, if you said, "Good morning, Your Honor," he might counter, "If you say so," rather brusquely. At the time, there were over 40 people who worked in the courthouse, and Judge Hopper made it his business to know all of them, to say hello, and to engage them in conversation every once in a while, especially the newcomers who might not feel welcome. Judge Hopper loved to preside over jury trials. This is kind of unusual because most judges hate trials since they are generally long and boring. He himself took over the voir dire, which is court talk for questioning the jurors, and one of his favorite questions to prospective jurors was that if they had any bumper stickers on their cars. He felt that from their answers, he could tell something about their personalities and how strong they felt about certain issues. Some had bumper stickers saying they were for gun control, said, "Honk if you love Jesus," or "My kid was student of the month at school." So that even after 17 years, after the judge had passed away, Catherine still caught herself looking at all the bumper stickers on cars. And then every once in a while, Judge Hopper would ask a juror, "If we were to stop the proceedings at this point without hearing the evidence, what would your verdict be?" The answers ranged from, "I can't say now because the defendant is in the room," or "Where there's smoke, there's fire." At which point the judge reminded them that the answer is not guilty, because every person is presumed innocent until proved guilty. Judge Hopper initiated a humane program for drunks. When they were arrested, they could work off their charge by helping to clean up the park for a day and then be released. One of the men who was a regular would always converse with him in the park. He often came up to court after adjournment to repay some of the money the judge had given him. Judge Hopper was the first judge to hold court in the new courthouse. He started the work furlough program, which enabled prisoners to work during the day and sleep nights in jail. Because Judge Hopper had a habit of conducting several trials at the same time, Catherine earned a lot of overtime in the years she clerked for him. One night, after they had deliberated till 9 o'clock, the bailiff walked the jury to their cars. Judge Hopper and the court reporter had already gone home. That left Catherine in a big, spooky courthouse all alone. It was just her bad luck that night that when she took the elevator down, it got stuck between the second floor and the mezzanine. Because she wasn't very tall, she couldn't reach the telephone. All she could do is sit on the floor and push the red panic button. After what seemed like hours, actually it was only 15 minutes, the door opened in between floors and she was able to climb out. But she never again got on that elevator alone at night. Catherine remembers that Judge Hopper, bursting over with experience, anecdotes, and observations about working in the justice system, was going to write a book called The Naked Courthouse, but left when he was elevated to the District Court of Appeals. Unfortunately, he died at an early age after heart bypass surgery. One of the most horrifying cases in Catherine's memory came during a preliminary hearing in criminal court. A 16-year-old retarded boy had been kidnapped, tortured, and murdered. He had observed several young men stealing some merchandise, and they were afraid that he might rat on them. They took him up to the foothills, tormented and did away with him, then buried him in a shallow grave. One of the defendants testified that as they were leaving, a hand reached out from the grave and grabbed his leg. They pled guilty and were sentenced without a trial. In another grisly trial, a witness testified that in the early morning fog, when the visibility was nearly nil, he was riding in the passenger seat on the left rear side when he heard a thud and thought someone had thrown something at their vehicle. When they stopped at a nearby gas station and looked at the car, it looked like someone had thrown a pizza at their car, like tomatoes and cheese, all warm and drippy. What had happened was that the car going in the opposite direction from theirs was loaded with four sailors and had passed them very close. One of the passengers had leaned out of the window to try to direct the driver. That passenger never got to instruct the driver because they were so close that the thud they heard was the sound of the man's head hitting their car so hard that his skull exploded, leaving blood and gore on their car. The driver of the car in which the passenger was killed was found guilty of reckless driving. After that, it was quite a few years before Catherine could even think about pizza, let alone eat one. In 1969, while she was working in the arraignment court, they brought in a long line of young men picked up on an assortment of civil disobedience charges stemming from demonstrations at Fresno State University. All of them were wearing yellow sweatshirts with the words Fresno County Jail printed on the back. The bailiff who had brought them in left them in the docket area and went out somewhere, probably to the bathroom. All Catherine remembers is that one of the prisoners managed to slip his chains, jump over the barrier in front of the courtroom, and was out the door. So there goes Catherine, 6 months pregnant, running out of the courtroom to find the bailiff. In the meantime, the man ran into the Del Webb building, stripped himself of the yellow sweatshirt, and disappeared. He was picked up several days later. Catherine also remembers the death of Marjorie Mason, for whom Fresno Center for Abused Women is named. After a long history of severe physical abuse, Marjorie was murdered. The frightening thing about this homicide was that the murderer turned out to be one of the bailiffs working right there in the courthouse, a man whom Catherine saw and rubbed elbows with almost every day, who wore the uniform of a peace officer, a man who was often in charge of suspects and prisoners. "You just never know," she said emphatically, shaking her head. Several other employees proved less than desirable. One had several jobs in the traffic department, including collecting fines. Exceedingly attractive, the mother of two, friendly and fun to be around, she was arrested on the job. Not for anything connected with her work, but for robbing banks. She had robbed at least two banks and was recognized from the photos. Still another employee collected fines from Mexican nationals and gave them bogus receipts. Because they hadn't paid their real fines, warrants for their arrest were issued. Fortunately, some of them had saved the phony receipts and showed them to the judge. This employee had taken thousands of dollars before she was caught. From 1979 to 1981, which was the year he retired, Catherine clerked for Judge Carl Evans. He had been an attorney for over 30 years before being elected. From the very beginning, the two of them admired and respected each other. Catherine felt that he treated everyone with fairness. Sometimes she even accused him of being a little too soft. Like the time there were tears in his eyes when he had to give a young woman a mandatory sentence of a year in jail. One day, Judge Evans was assigned a case involving a defendant who was 1368. That's court talk for crazy. Every time he came to court from the jail, he would sit in the holding tank, and before his case was called, everyone in the courtroom could hear the constant flushing of the toilet. The man was flushing his jumpsuit down the toilet. Since the bailiff would not bring him into court without his clothes, he returned him to jail. Well, after the third time of trying to get this case started, Judge Evans decided that if he flushed his suit again, he would hear the case regardless, since the witness had already been called and the lawyers were ready. Well, here he came in his underwear, holding a cigarette, and started puffing away. The judge remanded him to Superior Court, where he was found mentally incompetent. Because of the type of people the courts have to deal with, at times Catherine's heart hardened, and she just couldn't help but look at some defendants in disgust. That certainly was true of a particular woman who every so often would get arrested for drugs and disorderly conduct. One time she was picked up on the usual charges, along with violation of probation. Her face and arms were covered with sores, certainly not someone you would want to get close to. But somehow her public defender talked Judge Evans into releasing her into a live-in drug program. While filling out her release papers, Catherine put her 2 cents worth into the judge. "I bet she'll be back in a week," she told him. "Well, let's give her one more chance," he replied. In this instance, Catherine admits she has to eat her words because, several years later, there was an article about this same woman in the paper. She told her story and thanked the judge, the public defender, and the probation officer for giving her a chance to start over. For her last 5 years down at the courthouse, they promoted Catherine to senior courtroom clerk with a job of training new clerks. Of the 8 children in the Haw family, Catherine was next to the youngest, Ginny. She was only 10 when they lost their mother, May Tom Haw. Born in San Francisco, May was a woman of refinement, a devoted mother who took Catherine everywhere before the birth of Ginny, who could sing Chinese songs, loved to play mahjong, and promoted performances of Chinese operas in Fresno. When she died, although the family was devastated, it seems like the 5 children, who were still at home, became closer. Bernice, the 4th oldest, took care of her 4 younger brothers and sisters. Her father, Given, worked as a butcher in the Rex Meat Market on Tulare Street between F and G Streets. He loved to cook, and many of the women who bought meat from him would ask for recipes and for helpful hints on how to prepare meat. His real name was Guan, G-W-O-N. But somehow, when they were recording his birth certificate, somebody either saw or imagined they saw a dot or a fly speck above the first loop of the W in his name. That made an I and a V out of what was really a W. The man lived his whole life as Givon, when his real name was Guan. But it probably didn't matter because everybody called him Buddy anyway. And speaking of nicknames, they called Catherine's grandfather Fernando, a truly strange appellation for a Chinese person. It all had to do with the way he got to America. He originally landed in Mexico, could speak fluent Spanish, and the family believes swam across the border. The Haw family lived on Collins Avenue, right behind Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church in West Fresno. They certainly weren't rich, probably not even middle class, maybe on the upper limits of poor. But since Buddy was a butcher, they always had meat on the table, even during World War II when it was rationed. Lawson Inada, the poet, who is Ginny's age, lived right across the street. All the Haw children attended 6 years at Lincoln Elementary and another 6 at Edison Junior and Senior High. And those weren't the only schools they went to. Daily, from 5 to 9 in the evenings, and on Saturdays from 9 to 12, they attended Confucius School to learn Chinese. After 5 years of periodic attendance, Catherine managed to get to the 2nd grade of Confucius School. In her junior year in high school, she quit altogether because she got a job as a soda jerk at Swan's Donut Shop on Tulare Street, right across from the Hing Kee Company, where her brothers worked, and catty corner from the market where her dad was the butcher. If everybody inhaled, the donut shop could seat 12 people, and there was just enough room for 2 people to work behind the counter. Catherine made milkshakes, sundaes, banana splits, hot dogs, hamburgers, of which she ate her share, learned to make change, and interacted with her customers. The owner trusted her to open and close on weekends. She held on to that job until she was hired by the county in 1953, and even after that, filled in on weekends if her boss needed her. If there was anything onerous attached to living in West Fresno, Catherine never felt it. The streets outside her house were broad, safe, and attractive. She walked to and from school and work without any fear, knew just about everyone in her neighborhood and at school, and never felt the least bit inferior or outcast. In 1957, after a 9-year courtship, Catherine married Han Fan Chin. Han Fan is also a graduate of Edison. He always assumed that even though he was born in China while his parents were visiting there, that he was an American citizen since his father had served in the U.S. military. But that turned out not to be the case, and so, surprisingly, he had to go through the naturalization process in 1980. Until his retirement, Han Fan was a self-employed grocery store owner and butcher. His father had purchased the grocery store near the entrance of Kearney Boulevard on Fresno Street, originally called Contino's Market, run by the parents of Dick Contino, the famous accordion player. He and his brother changed the name to Joe's Food Market. The market catered to a slowly diminishing Italian-American population which used to reside in the neighborhood. It has since been sold and converted into a mini-mart. For 12 years, Catherine and Han Fan tried to get pregnant. They pursued all avenues of remediation except surgery, consulted experts, and went to a variety of fertility doctors, but to no avail. It was only after they pretty much had given up that she conceived, and in 1969, Jeffrey was born. He became a financial planner for Equitable Life. Catherine was very active in her church, the First Chinese Baptist Church of Fresno. She attended Bible study classes, sang in the choir, and belonged to a group of mature women who quilted, sewed, knitted, and crocheted items to be sold at the church's annual Food and Fun Festival every October. Besides the memorabilia connected with her immediate family, there were two framed photos Catherine treasured most of all. One was of the old Fresno County Courthouse. "Here is where I worked in the traffic department for all that time," she would say, pointing to a door on the ground floor just to the right of the outside staircase that went up to the second floor. The other photo was of a group shot taken in 1991 of the judges she worked for lined up in two rows. "Here are most of them," she told me with some emotion as her finger went down each row of the robed men and women she obviously respected so much. Victor Papadakis, John Nip Gallagher, Sandra Snyder, Carl P. Evans, Annette LaRue, W. Kent Lewis, Ralph Putman, Edward Sarkisian, Michael Feinberg, Vincent McGraw, Joan McIntosh, and Armando Rodriguez. "A society without a fair justice system is no society at all," she said emphatically. And today, when you talk to the folks at the courthouse who worked with her, you always get an extremely positive feedback. Everyone agrees that Catherine was a very valuable member of Fresno County's court system for all those many years. P.S. I'm happy to report that one of Catherine's relatives still works for the courts. I'm talking about her nephew, Randall Hall, who works for the Sheriff's Court Services Unit. Randall carries on the memory of his aunt. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, excerpts from Take Me to the River, edited by Joelle and Coke Halliwell. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story. Until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.